Hey, Dream Team. Welcome back to my podcast. My name is Anissa. This is my podcast. Coffee is my boyfriend. In this episode, I am talking with one of my really good friends. In fact, I have known him since he was born. It is I would call him my brother in a way. Yeah, kind of is. His name's Tom. We've grown up together. Got amazing insights on this episode. You will love it. We talk successes. We talk failure. We talk thought processes. We talk self-reflection. Please enjoy. You will get a lot out of this episode. Thanks. Bye. Hey, hey, Dream Team. Welcome back to Coffee is My Boyfriend. My name is Anissa, and this is my podcast, Coffee is My Boyfriend, and it will be and forever, and I love it. And I've actually got one here right now as I talk to one of my oldest friends, like in terms of how long we've known each other, because I knew you when you were born. Isn't that crazy?
It is crazy.
This is my friend Tom, ladies and gentlemen. Tom, welcome to my podcast.
Thanks for having me.
I just thought it would be great to have this discussion with you about many different topics, particularly since we've known each other for such a long period of time and we've grown up together. And essentially, Tom's family and my family, well, we've kind of merged together to create really one family. So I grew up with you kind of being another younger brother. Mm-hmm. And your sisters also being my sisters. So, yeah, welcome. That was a pretty long intro.
Such a fabulous intro, though.
Oh, such a fabulous intro. You've just come back from China.
I have.
And you have been learning, and you've been kind of pursuing this travel to China back and forth a few times now.
Yeah, that was my fourth time going to China, and the last trip was 3 months or 2 months, and all up I've spent about 6 months in China.
Wow. So what kind of, why China for starters, and what kind of prompted this idea of submerging yourself into the culture?
I really go to China because I started studying Chinese at university. You know, I did not go to university when I was 18. I went back when I was like 22 or something. And before I went back, I was doing these applications and they were like, you know, what is your second language? Can you speak a second language? And I was like, oh no, I can't. And I was like, why can't I speak a second language?
Yeah.
So then I just Googled the most spoken language and it was Chinese. And, you know, I enrolled in a Bachelor of Arts with a major in public relations and a major of language, and you major in one, and I chose Chinese.
Yeah.
And then that was how it started. And I go to China because in China they speak Chinese.
Yeah.
And, you know,
get out of town on a bus.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Chinese, Mandarin.
Yeah, Chinese, Mandarin.
Yeah.
Yeah, generally we just call it Chinese, like the United Nations calls it Chinese. Like there is, of course, you know, Cantonese and Shanghainese and all the other dialects. But, you know, if you go to school in China, in mainland China, they will teach you Mandarin.
Okay. And how different are those, like, dialects compared to, like, Chinese Mandarin? Do they so if someone came up to you and spoke a different dialect, could you understand parts of what they're saying or not really? Does it completely change?
You know, I'm not an expert for two reasons. The first is that my Chinese itself is not fluent, and the second is I do not know all the dialects.
Right.
But from what I do know, like Cantonese, you know, the hello in Cantonese and the hello in Mandarin are very similar, you know, like Mandarin Chinese is just ni hao.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I will butcher this, but the Cantonese one is like ni hao.
Okay.
You know, it's slightly different. And you can really have a guess. You know, it's this very strange thing where you can just guess and you'll be right.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's people in Finland and Sweden, they can understand each other even though they just speak their own language. Like,
yeah.
But they can't, you know, a Swedish person can't just speak Finnish. But if they listen to someone in Finnish, they just understand what's going on.
Yeah.
It feels like this very inherent thing at the time. If you just flow with it, it just goes.
Also, there would be like a space within that of just understanding, you know, body language and obviously context in which you're having this conversation. There would be elements of that you can kind of piece together as well on a subconscious level.
Yeah, yeah. It, you know, a really hard thing at the start of learning language, I think, is you try and think about everything that's going on and you try and like break down every word that's being said.
Mm-hmm.
But the more you think about it, the harder it gets, and you just trip over yourself. It becomes very awkward.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but you know, I have friends who are mainland Chinese born and bred, and then so they are experts on Mandarin, I guess. And then I have other friends whose native language is Cantonese. You know, they're from the southern province of like Guangdong, or they're from Hong Kong. And they, people can text each other and one can speak Cantonese and the other one can speak Mandarin, and they will generally get the idea, mm. even though grammar structures are different and stuff. But, and they do, they sort of use a separate alphabet. Like mainland Chinese uses a simplified version, and then Hong Kong uses the traditional characters. But they, like, they can understand what each other is saying.
Did you have to text in Chinese?
Yeah, I can type. Everything I can say, I can type, and I can read what I can say. But I do not handwrite. You know, there's two different types of memories. There's recall memory,
yeah.
where it's like, you know, what is the capital of Australia?
Yeah.
You know, answer that question. And then there's recognition memory. So what is the capital of Australia? Is it A, Brisbane, B,
yeah,
Sydney,
right.
C, Canberra? You know,
yeah.
And it's a lot harder to get something into your recall memory, you know. That's mm. why multiple choice is much easier than
mm-hmm.
free response. So, and I, you know, Chinese people spend hundreds and thousands of hours drilling writing characters by hand.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, would it be better if I could handwrite? Yeah, but there is a cost to learning to do something, you know, and it is not a cost I'm willing to take up at the moment.
Yeah. Do they, what have you noticed in terms of major differences between sort of Western culture and what you've experienced in your travels overseas? Because, I mean, obviously, two different cultural
mm.
identities. That aside, if we're talking things like family and like work ethic and
mm.
socials, and even down to, obviously, I'm someone who's very interested in those areas doing comedy, because
uh-huh.
we have to comment on that in our societal structure. Have you noticed major differences or things that you kind of gone, wow, like we would never do that at home?
I think there's a few patterns that come up consistently, you know, like complaints cultures make when they're in the other one. So a common complaint of Chinese people when they're in Australia is they feel that everything in Australia shuts really early. They're like, oh my God, there's nothing to do at 9 o'clock on a Saturday night unless you want to go nightclubbing or something. But
yeah.
in China, if you're on the, you know, not even just the central, the CBD of Shanghai, but the outer suburbs too, like there's well-lit areas and everyone's walking around drinking tea and eating barbecue and stuff, you know, it is common to just go out and hang out with your friends.
Does it shut down at any point?
It does shut down. It's not this 24/7 idea. You know, I had this idea, like we grew up in the country with like 15,000 people.
Yeah.
And I had this idea that when I got to Brisbane one day, like it just never shuts down. Like
yeah.
it's like everything's open till 7 a.m. and there's still people there. But, you know, like nightclubs and stuff don't work like that anywhere really, you know.
No.
It shuts at 2. And I, you know, I've been to San Francisco, I've been to Shanghai,
mm.
you know, and they all shut down and there's no one there. Like anyone
mm-hmm.
who says like the city never sleeps, like there's areas where people are around and stuff, but
people need to sleep.
Yeah, they all stop, you know.
Yeah. Okay. We did mention when we were traveling in the car recently that you notice there is this idealism of a work life
mm.
when it comes to sort of the Chinese culture of being at work for longer periods of time.
Mm.
But you also made an interesting comment about how it doesn't necessarily mean that they are any more proactive in their work.
Yeah, and you know, this is an observation I've made through conversation with people. You know, a friend of mine works for a company, you know, it is quite a large telecommunications company,
mm.
and they have different departments, and what they said to me is that the research team has to be there for 10 more hours a week than everyone else. And I was
yeah.
like, you know, do they, what are they doing more work in this 10 hours? It's like, no, not really, they just need to be seen to be there or they'll be fired. Like
wow.
there is this expectation of you will be here, and it's we stop, I feel like we often stop measuring things which are important, like output.
Yeah.
Because it can be hard to measure output. Like if you're working on a problem, you know, is solving one problem an hour good output? Like you might spend 3 hours solving one problem and then
yeah.
solve two problems in half an hour.
Yeah.
Like it's not this consistent thing which is easy to manage.
Yeah.
And I think that becomes more complex and harder for people to value when the structure gets bigger. You know, when there's the manager and the sub-manager and then the worker bees down the bottom.
Yeah.
But when you're in a smaller company, like you work with the boss who is also the owner, and they see exactly what you've done. You know,
mm.
I worked in small businesses, and you would do something and the manager would see it, and then they'd go to the meeting with the owner the next day and they'd be like, oh yeah, you know, this worker you know, did this thing, it was really great. And the manager worked quite closely with you too. Like there becomes less lines of communication so the communication can become clearer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've mentioned this problem of, you know, this kind of culture of just working to work and being seen to be working.
Yeah.
And it, not focusing on output. But I don't think that is a specific thing to Chinese companies. I've heard similar complaints about Western companies too.
Of course. I mean, you only have to look at certain occupations within Western culture where it's, you know, you need to be seen to be pulling these sort of hours to, I don't know, show your commitment or your, you know, sell your soul to whatever company it is that is giving you the paycheck, so to speak.
Yeah, it's like, you know, if you really cared about the company, you'd be here till 7 every night,
That whole philosophy or that whole idea is so unbelievably flawed, because what is your investment into a company that is not yours? Like, what is your emotional investment? The only emotional investment you have to a company that is not yours is the fact that they are going to give you a paycheck in order for you to then have the emotional investment into your own life. So whether that is, you know, the holiday, the weekend trip away, the living expenses, those costs, there's actually no loyalty to the company.
Yeah, it sort of sounds like you see working for the company as a means to an end to living your life. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, how long would it take for any company to replace a person?
Mm. Yeah, I'm sure they have HR statistics on exactly how long and how much it costs.
Exactly, but it's not long. Yeah. It's not. They will replace you in, for example, say if a person died. This is obviously a morbid kind of ideal idea, but say if a person died, they would already have replaced the person before the obituary came out in the paper. Like, that's where we are as like a cultural society. We're starting to become expendable in the way that we are produced.
Yeah.
And that I'm challenged on a lot in how people are no longer living. I feel like they're just doing.
Yeah. What do you mean by you're challenged on that?
I'm challenged on that because it's just not the way that I live my life, and I'm pushing myself more and more out of what I believe is that normalization of work culture, particularly in Australia, just because I can't sit at a desk for a period of time. I can't see the necessary, you know, results in making someone stay at a place or a location for a period of time to get work done. For me, it's like, if that takes 5 minutes, that takes 5 minutes. That doesn't mean that it was any less involved for someone who made it take an hour.
Yeah.
But it doesn't need to be processed in such a way. Like you said, why are we focusing so much on the input and not the output? Like, how long does it take for the output to happen? Some things will take longer than expected and some things will take shorter than expected. Why can't we measure on that output rather than how long we have to be in a certain place?
Yeah, and this is a fair question. You know,
I don't know, what are your thoughts?
I think there's a hard question to answer. How do you measure output? You know, what is output? If your job is to answer phones or something, or, I don't know, file documents.
Yeah.
Like, if your job is not tightly connected to profits, like, jobs like sales are very easy to measure the output.
Mm.
You know, what is your output? You know, I sold 60,000 units. It's very, very simple.
Yeah.
Even lawyers and stuff is much more simple. You know, it's like, how many hours did you bill? Accountants can bill hours.
Yeah.
But not everyone can do it. And I don't have an answer. How do you measure people in a way which is more effective for the company and, you know, better for the people's well-being?
Yeah.
Because I can understand that there's this problem where there's this manager and he's got 10 people under him.
Yeah.
And all he saw was Stacey at the drink fountain having a chat, you know.
Yeah.
Didn't see all this other stuff, you know.
Yeah.
But I feel like it becomes this problem where Stacey becomes really efficient and she's only got to do work for 3 hours a day, you know, out of the 8 hours, and then she can just mess around.
Yeah.
You know, but she becomes punished for being so efficient. So she would be better off just taking 8 hours to do the work.
Yeah.
You know, and we have this 40-hour work week generally.
Yeah.
And, you know, how can your job take 40 hours? Like, how can this be this consistent number?
Yes.
You know, and then we run into a new problem where, well, you know, sometimes it might take 60 hours you've got to do work, and then the next week you only do 20.
Mm.
And I think people fear that it becomes, if you let people take their own direction, they will take advantage of it. You know,
yeah.
It's like people say, oh, I only needed to do 20 hours this week and you paid me my 80 grand or whatever.
Yeah.
But then they start taking 20 hours every week and they fear that the people will just start robbing the company of their time.
Yeah. But if this is the job that needs to be done,
mm.
as long as it is done,
mm.
then shouldn't you be paid what it was worth to be done in the first place?
Yeah.
When it's not done, then of course that needs to have a further discussion.
Yeah. It's, yeah, I feel like it gets really messy when you get down there. And I'm not saying that what happens is right.
No.
I'm just sort of offering, you know, what it would be like to be the manager, and then you've got your manager above you being like, your department's not productive enough. And then you just want to fix this problem, and you believe that the problem will be fixed if you just get people to stay longer. You know,
yeah.
It's like, oh, totally.
They don't have enough time to do whatever they're supposed to be
yeah.
doing. Whereas it probably doesn't even come down to that. It probably comes down to direction
mm.
or communication.
Yeah.
You know, the amount of things that are messed up, and I hear this a lot with some of my friends in more like government sectors, and I can't comment so much on the private, but a lot of like time is, I say loosely, wasted because of communication breakdowns. And it's just like, oh, you said this and this is what I've interpreted, and then it comes back, oh no, that's not right. So then more time is put into like fixing it again, whereas this lack of communication skill could have stopped, like could have fixed it the first time, so
mm.
to speak, or could have got the message across the first time. And that seems to be a common thread that keeps going into this idea of like spending more time at work or spending more time on things because this communication breakdown has been happening.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, I mean, and you can jump in on this, but this is how I sort of see it. We aren't learned actual fundamental skills at school to help us connect and work together and collaborate mm-hmm. with people in everyday society.
Mm-hmm.
Like when we go to primary school and high school, we're not taught how to do our taxes.
Mm-hmm.
We're not taught how to budget our lifestyle. We're not taught how to communicate with other people and other like personality types. They assume we learn that at school, but we don't.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
We don't learn those skill sets. We just learn behaviors around those skill sets that have been conducted by other groups before them.
Yeah.
Like, for example, very, you know, what do you call it? Stereotypical ideas of like jocks and nerds and all that kind of
mm.
stuff. That's all been established beforehand. So there's kind of this idea behind it before you even come in.
Yeah.
So we aren't learned these fundamental skill sets and tools to be able to then transfer them into everyday life. And I feel like from there, it's just a snowballing effect
mm.
of creating more mess because we just don't have these human fundamentals, in my opinion.
Mm.
What do you think? Where's your headspace on that one?
You know, I think what I'm hearing from you is that you feel that the schooling system itself is being adequate for life, you know, like it doesn't teach you how to live.
No.
And, you know, I would really agree with that. There's a lot of things it doesn't teach people. For me, I think people need to be taught how to learn. Like, when you show people, you know, you can learn this, you can learn anything you want. And if
mm.
you enjoy it and you do it more, you will learn it.
Mm.
But I don't think people are generally, you know, empowered enough to be taught to learn. It's like, you know, you wanna be an accountant, you can learn to use Excel spreadsheets. Like, anyone could do it.
Yeah.
Like, I can't do it because I've never studied how to use an Excel spreadsheet.
Yeah.
You know, and that's okay. And the other thing is, not everyone needs to. Like,
yeah.
Loads of people can go through their life and never open an Excel spreadsheet, and that's okay.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like there has been, like, this homogenization of education to specifics.
Yeah.
So everyone's getting the same education on these very, very specific subjects. And they're just subjects not everyone needs, whereas
mm.
I feel like there should almost be, you know, a more homogenized education of homogenous topics, you know?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
And just teach people about, like, a few skills. A big thing I think they teach poorly in a lot of schools is self-reflection. You know, my big issue with a lot of self-reflection is that you have to submit it. Like, so I don't think other people should read your self-reflection, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you should be given the structure, you know, what happened, why did it happen, you know, what did I like, what did I like. There's loads of different models to use for your self-reflection, and then you just write honestly and you don't worry about grammar and you just spew it out onto the page.
That would be amazing.
Yeah. And it, but other people can't check your self-reflection and tell you if it's good. The only way you can really like, say, if it's good or bad, is if you didn't self-reflect, you know? Did you self-reflect on, you know, how you went to work today and it sucked? It's like, oh, well, actually, I wrote about how I want to buy a new pair of shoes. You know, it's not really helpful, self-reflection. It's off topic. But if you can stay on topic and write honestly about it, like, there's a lot of growth to be found in reflecting on yourself, I think.
There is something, like you just touched on then, about how you, this idea of like submitting these self-reflections. So it's almost like there is this understanding need for people to now self-reflect, or for generations to now self-reflect, particularly moving forward and seeing what is happening further down the line in terms of economic change eco-structure change and everything like that. And if we did have this ability and inherent nature to self-reflect on what we are doing as a person to impact everything else, there would be, I think, a greater change in how we conduct ourselves to how we are currently. But that's another subject altogether.
Yeah.
But when you talk about sort of submitting this self-reflection, I find this really interesting because they are starting to do this. It's like, oh yeah, we do self-awareness classes or whatever, and then we've got to, you know, share with the class or share with the group or submit it to the teacher. And that just adds in, I don't know how you feel about this, but for me, I feel like it adds in another layer of anxiety around whether I am right or wrong as a human being.
Yeah.
Because when you start getting to someone who's going to mark it right or wrong or correct it or change it or whatever it might be, you start to really tailor a person in what they feel like they can and can't say.
You start to ask the question, is it okay to be me?
Exactly. Is it okay to be me, or do I need, am I not right as a human? Am I missing something?
I think there's a huge problem, this being sure of ourselves and just being, you know, and it, you know, submitting it, I can definitely say it adds that anxiety of like, is it okay to be me? I feel like my problem is often with reflections is, can I even write about this topic, this thing that happened? Like, friends of mine I was just in China with, they had to write reflections for the internship they were with.
Yeah.
But they wanted to write about all this stuff they did in China, like, you know, meeting people out in bars and stuff. But those weren't topics which were acceptable for reflection.
Right.
So they couldn't even do it, you know. And we would talk and we would reflect through these things. You know, it's like, oh, you know, I met this person and, you know, the conversation was really boring and I really hated being with them. And then they figure out, it's like, you know, I would just leave that conversation next time. Like, why did I do it?
Yeah.
So, you know, they found out what happened, what they liked, what didn't they like, and what they would do in the future. You know, and this is a great basis for reflection.
And that's a great basis for learning.
Yeah, yeah. But instead they had to write, like, they're like, they made stuff up. They were like, you know, I don't even know what I can write. I'll just make something up to fulfill my 600-word quota or whatever it is, you know?
Yeah.
It becomes unhelpful.
And then a 600-word quota.
Yeah. Word counts are a huge issue, I feel.
Yes. Yeah. Especially when it comes to something that is self-experienced or self-reflection, whatever you would like to call it. How long is a piece of string?
Yeah. And sometimes I personally feel, unsure or insecure of my reflections, because I will write, and some topics I'll write just 4 pages and just burn through them, and they're like, oh, I wrote so much. And then other topics I write half a page and I'm like, I'm done with this topic, you know?
Yeah.
And then if I'm in a mood where I'm not feeling so sure about things, I will think, you know, is what I've written enough? Is my self-reflection good enough?
Yeah. And then there's no, I think what's interesting is there's no real understanding of, does that actually impact? Does that make change for that person as well? If you're editing your self-reflection in such a way that you're making up subject matter because you know that this particular person is going to read it, or it's for this particular subject, or it's to, you know, for this particular quota, at what point do you completely disconnect and you write for the outcome and not for, like, what it's meant to be, which is to be internal and to be for you?
The audience changes, you know.
Yeah.
It's important to write for the audience, and in self-reflection we write for ourselves. But when we submit it, the audience becomes someone else.
Yeah.
So we're now judging ourselves on a stage. Whereas, you know, I feel it should be done in private.
Yeah. Interesting. All right.
I'm wondering if you had a self-reflection process or method.
I do have a self-reflection process. I think it's, for me, it's been something that has been so unbelievably valuable as a tool set and a skill set, particularly going through creative processes. I was talking about this actually on a friend of mine podcast. They interviewed me this week, and Dan asked me the question. He's like, you're making all this stuff, you're doing all these things, he goes, and he's been watching my journey, and he goes, I know you're up to something, like, I know there's other things in play. I'm like, yeah, I know where I want to be. I've kind of reverse engineered that to where I want to go and what I have to do in these steps to lead to that space. But in order for me to achieve that, I need to grow as a person, and I need to be wary of what I have produced and what I'm lacking and all that kind of stuff as well, in order for me to be, I guess, well-rounded to move forward. The biggest thing for me when it comes to self-reflection is to I take the perfection, like the element of perfectionism, I try and take that out of whatever I'm creating. And the same with self-reflection. It's like, it's not about necessarily what you didn't achieve or what you wanted as the ultimate outcome. It's not necessarily about that in terms of self-reflection. I think it's sometimes about how you conducted yourself through those challenges or whatever it might be. Or how, were there certain elements that worked really well for you, or were there certain ways that you responded that were unhelpful or really helpful or whatever it might be. I do a self-reflection process every night. Now, initially, I mean, I say that like, oh, wow, like, you're so perfect. No, no. Initially, it wasn't something that kind of came to mind. I really noticed it being such a valuable tool when I went to university. And again, I'm not here nor there about university. I don't think it's a must or a must not. It's whatever you feel you need to do. For me, I studied a Bachelor of Photography at the Queensland College of Art. And through that, you know, we're getting judged on our art. We're getting, which again is an interesting subject matter, in like an interesting topic in itself, because how can you possibly be judged on art? Like, what is the criteria of that?
Yeah, who says what is good art?
Who says what is good art? So it was interesting for me, coming from a space of having a lecturer or a tutor and myself, and then thinking that because they're teaching me, their word is right. And then reflecting back and being like, hang on, what they're just expressing is their personal choice or their personal preference. Or they're giving you, the best ones were the ones that were giving me more questions about what I was doing. So they were trying to make me more self-reflective. When I started doing that as part of my process, when I started, stopped trying to please what I thought they wanted and started listening to the questions and reflecting back on myself and then answering the questions in my way and being so unbelievably grounded and could back myself 100% in whatever output I made, that's when I noticed the skill set started to grow. That's when I started to notice that I created what, you know, whoever's eyes, but in my eyes personally, better work or great work. Because the self-reflected, reflective process was there enough that I could be 100%, I had 100% conviction in whatever I was doing. Whether it was a learning curve or not, I did notice it was just such a powerful tool to be able to sit back and just go, what are the bigger questions at play? Am I questioning myself? Can I back myself in every answer? And if I couldn't, if there was something that I did that I was like, I can't back myself in that, or I can't tell that person why I'm doing it this way or whatever it is, I felt like I needed to dig deeper. And when I did was when I felt, one, confident in my work, confident in my direction, and also confident in conversation. It's self-reflection is just something that builds you as a person, but you can never explain that process to anybody. It's one of those things where I feel like you see the output of that, like you see the product of doing that. Or you see it in other people. Sometimes you're like, how did they just, they were so awesome in how they navigated that, or they were so, you know, I've seen the change in them, and then, oh, they've gone from this person to this person. Like, they've had to do some work to get there. So I think, like, being so self-reflective, particularly my process, is just at the end of the night, I'll just lie down on my pillow, and I go through at least 5 things that happened in the day as a sense of gratitude.
Mm.
Like, for example, today there were some challenges with some recording equipment for my show. And I was in the car with my friend Nicole and we're driving back and we just figured it all out, right? And I just said to her, I am just so unbelievably grateful
mm-hmm.
that I get to go through this challenge
mm-hmm.
and I get to learn about this right now.
Yeah.
Because moving forward, there'll be a place and time and whatever it might be that one, either I'll be challenged with a similar circumstance or I'm going to have someone else doing this for me
mm-hmm.
and I have such now empathy and understanding of what that is like
yeah.
for them, so I don't have an expectation on what that work is.
Yeah, it sounds like you are reframing challenges and problems as, you know, experiences of growth.
Yeah, I would never want... A big change for me in my personal growth and my personal development is that I've never wanted anything to seem negative and to drown me in reality of life, so to speak.
Uh-huh.
I feel like a lot of people are like, oh, this happened to me today, and oh, I can't do this because of this person, and oh, I can't do this because of that thing happening and that thing happening, mm-hmm. now I can't do this and whatever it might be. And there's this constant idea of like not being 100% responsible and reflecting or bouncing, you know, responsibilities onto other things or other people, other circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you have 100% responsibility and you have 100% ownership over your actions,
mm.
your words and your attitude. So your actions and your attitude are the two things really.
Mm.
So when something comes your way and it's not ideal,
mm.
how do you deal with that?
Yeah, it sounds to me like you try very hard to take control of the things that are going on in your life.
To an extent.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I understand that there are things that are out of my control.
Yeah.
Like I said, I can only control my action and my attitude.
Yeah.
If things happen that are out of my control, then they happen. But how I respond to whatever that is completely up to me.
When do you feel like you're making a good response to something out of your control?
I think for me personally, and again, everyone's going to measure this differently, it's how much did I emotionally get involved that it either hurt me or someone else?
Mm-hmm.
Again, that's not really a measurable impact. But for example, going to university in my younger years, you know, I was so hell-bent on perfectionism and so hell-bent on getting things right and being on time and all these kind of things. And it would beat me up if I would beat myself up if it wasn't perfect or I was a minute late or if it was all this sort of stuff. Or worse, if it got to a point where I was out of control, in my opinion, I would blame other people or other things. It would make me angry or upset for the whole day.
Mm.
So now I get to a point where I measure this success in terms of my own personal growth from a space of how long do I emotionally hold on to this thing?
Mm-hmm.
How much does it actually impact other parts of my life, positive or negative?
Mm.
And how much of it did I kind of take on too?
Yeah, I'm sort of seeing what your thoughts are at that time. You know, when you're at university, there's no time to be late.
Yep.
No time to get things wrong. You know, there's no room for error in your life.
Yeah.
But you know, at that time of your life, when there was no room for error, it made you feel bad. You know, and when you felt bad, you pushed your feelings of badness.
Yeah.
On other people. Of course. You know,
and a lot of people do that. I mean, road rage is a classic example.
Yeah, and now you really measure your success as, you know, if I can not push my feelings of badness onto other people.
Or myself, or hurt anyone.
Yeah, or crush myself with them.
Yeah.
You know, that would be okay.
It's not productive in anyone moving forward.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not a nice thing to feel.
No, but what about you? What about you in terms of personal growth? Like, what have you found? Do you self-reflect? Do you have other skill sets that you use or tools that you use?
You know, I've tried the self-reflection of, like, self-reflect every night or something, or have a schedule, but, you know, I just would stop. So what I do now is sometimes I'm just sitting there with space, you know, I'm not, I'm not trying to jump to the next thing, and I just be like, I'm going to start writing. Sometimes I will write it on my phone, like with a little pen.
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes I mostly write in a book, but I do not type.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a lot of research showing that writing with your hand is very, very different from typing when it comes to like,
well, it's personalized.
Connecting with your mind. Yeah. And I would just write out, and it, you know, especially if I'm feeling bad, and I don't know why, like I will write and I will just, whatever comes out is okay. And often a large part of it is nonsense, you know, but so I normally find something and I'm like, you know, that does suck, that bit, you know, what if I could do something about that?
Mm.
Well, what can I do about that, you know? Like, because I think I share a similar feeling with you, is I don't want to be, you know, sitting in the car, stuck in the mud and spinning the wheels, you know,
yeah.
And just keep pushing on the accelerator and spinning them more.
Yeah.
What really you need to do is get out of the car and, you know, put some sticks under the tire so it can grip and get out of the mud. You know,
yeah.
It's if what you're doing is not really working, you know, but you can take control and change that.
Yeah.
You know, you've made the choice to do what you're doing. And, you know, choices are not always so explicit. You know, we just do something because that's what we always do. And it'd be hard to break out of that or even step back and be like, oh God, I'm really just spinning my tires in the mud. Like,
yeah,
I need to get out of the car.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think self-reflection helps with that, you know. And when I self-reflect, sometimes I come along phrases, you know, I ask the question, why am I doing that? You know, like, oh, that's just what I do.
Yeah.
And normally that is just the most, you know, the most problematic thing. It's like, you know, why do I sit in the car and push on the accelerators? That's what you do.
Yeah.
You know, but... And then if I challenge that and look at, you know, what else could I do? You know? And maybe I don't know anything about getting cars unbolted, but I know I can Google stuff. You know, so how can I find a solution? You know?
Yeah.
And, you know, hopefully you come across a solution which is helpful, but maybe you don't, and that's okay too. You know, it's okay to try things that don't work.
Yeah.
You know, not everything has to work out the first time.
Yeah.
And, you know, that doesn't mean doing things that don't work isn't painful. You know, it can be really painful.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, lots of things we do are quite painful. But it doesn't mean they're not worth it, you know?
Yeah. And working into, like, the idea of pain. Hi, we're just podcasting. Pause this for a second. No. We're just podcasting. Calm your farm. Going back into this idea of, like, failure.
Uh-huh.
Now, this is a really interesting concept I find in Western society, and myself growing up in an immigrant based family, and this idea of constantly having to achieve in order to survive.
Yeah.
Like, that's kind of the mindset that I've grown up with. It's like, if you don't achieve, you might not survive. Like,
yeah,
that is the reality of the situation. Then I took that through into my life for a very long period of time and saw failure as such a bad thing. Like, this is almost like, you're a bad person because you're failing. You are not worth society's eyes because you're failing.
Mm.
I've actually gone through a beautiful process, and I'm so grateful for it, and having amazing mentors around this, learning and restructuring and learning my thinking, or relearning my thinking, to understand that failure is like the best thing, as long as you learn from it.
Yeah.
But failure is the best thing for you because it allows you to find the right option or right answer for you.
Yeah.
How do you feel about what you've discovered in terms of the word failure and how that works in your life?
Yeah, just quickly, you know, when you talk about failure, I sort of hear it coming back to this, you know, when you reflect, you don't want what's going on to crush you.
Yeah.
And, you know, it sort of seems like what you're talking about with failure, like, it's okay to fail, but I'm not going to let it destroy me in the process.
Yeah.
But it's really the self-destruction of the failure which, you know, bangs you up. It's not so much, you know, going into university to study law and dropping out because it really wasn't for you, you know, that if you then just, you know, quit everything in life and just decide not to pursue anything you want, you know, I feel like that would be much more painful than the pain of, you know, failing at a degree and, you know,
yeah,
being embarrassed. You know, it is really painful, but in the long run, it is much better than...
It's almost building this resilience in a way too, though. Like, every time you do have something that's a bit of a setback, let's not call it a failure, let's say it's a setback, you build the resilience for the next thing because you've already experienced what that feels like. So you're like, oh, well, it can't be as bad as whatever that was.
Yeah.
And then you build that up again.
Yeah. You know, it's an interesting thing you bring up because I often do not think explicitly about, oh, you know, it's not as bad as that thing when we talk about resilience and it building up. what I find is my internal emotional and, you know, even physiological reactions, like anxiety can be very, very physiological, and so can other feelings.
Yeah.
You know, they become less intense as I build resilience. You know, so if you know, the first time you do something bad, like, I don't know, let's say you go, you do a presentation at work and you bomb it, like it's just awful. Yeah. You know, it feels really painful the first time.
All right, my mom's going to interrupt this podcast for a second.
Susan?
Okay, so my parents have said hello, we've dealt with that, we've come back, and we were talking about perceived ideas of failure and what that kind of looks like, and how have you structured your life around that? Because you've done a lot of things too, just kind of come to where you are currently in your life and what you've been experiencing. So, failure.
Yeah, you know, I feel like I don't have a good answer for that. Like, I don't feel like I have a good understanding of what it is failure is for me, what makes me feel bad. I think what I try and do, and what I'm trying to do more of, is just, you know, feeling what feels good for me and, you know, moving towards that. So, like, you know, if I find something in psychology while I'm studying, you know, say, you know, like, child development from the ages 2 to 4, like how best to facilitate child development. Like, if that topic is really interesting to me,
yeah,
what I try and do is move more towards that. And instead of, you know, seeking out challenges and seeing places to fail, you know, I see this thing that I want to do or look at more and understand better, and I just do more of that. And then I suppose things don't work out, and I suppose at times I feel like a sense of failure, but it tends to be like a self-defeating idea of, you know, I haven't done enough. You know, it doesn't matter how much I've done, I haven't done enough, and therefore what I've done is a failure. But I can't really think of examples where I tried to do something and I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah, it is, I think the biggest failures in my life are not trying to do things, you know, like, there's certainly been things I've done and failed. There's no doubt about that. You know, but
yeah. But when you think of like perceived ideas of failure, like for me personally, it wasn't actually a perceived idea of failure from anybody else but myself. So it was creating this expectation of myself and what I knew that, what I thought I knew I could achieve, or maybe being over ambitious in an aspect because I didn't have the tool or the skill set yet. And then in my eyes, not achieving that meant that it was a failure, even though I potentially still achieved the outcome, or I got through the event, or I got through whatever it is. Like a big example would be, you know, let's just use university or study as an example, because most people go through that, whether it's high school or further tertiary education. Kind of going, oh my gosh, I've got all these assignments to do, and I've got this minimal time to get it done, and I've also got work, and I've also got this, and I've also got these commitments, and blah blah blah, how am I supposed to get this done? And sometimes you can put a level of a standard of getting things done, and you're like, I'm going to achieve, I don't know, A's or B pluses or whatever across the board with all these things. And then when you do them and you complete them, say you do get some A's, you get some B's, and maybe you get a C plus or whatever, you've completed it all. But to you, because you set that expectation of what you thought you could possibly achieve with that outcome, it's a perceived failure, even though you got all the work done.
Yeah, it becomes a failure in your reality.
Yeah. So it's like challenging that idea of when is it, like, it kind of goes with this idea of when people do goal setting and they're like, set an achievable goal. And I'm like, well, if it's achievable though, is it really pushing you to learn something better or bigger about yourself?
Yeah, what if people set goals which are too low?
Exactly. So it's like setting an achievable goal. That's all well and good and great to say, to kind of not, you know, have pressure on a person, but if it's already achievable, then what's the likelihood of one, them doing it, and two, them growing from it?
Yeah, is there really a good result from it if they achieve it?
Yeah. So I've kind of come from this space for me personally, where if I set my bar high, and not get too like attached to it, yes, enough to drive me forward, but understand that I understand for myself that there's a high bar. It's not me saying like, if I don't reach this, I'm a failure. It's like, this is a high bar, but I'm going to try and reach for it. It's that whole saying of like, you know, shoot for the stars and you'll end up on the moon or whatever it is. So I'll set my high bar knowing that everybody else sets their bar at like 50% of my bar. Now, if I achieve 80% of that, in my mind, I have already overachieved. Yeah, did I hit the bar? No, I didn't, but I can do that again next time. So I can set that bar again, higher again, and then if I achieve 80% of that, then I've already hit that bar that I originally set.
Yeah.
But sometimes I feel people set their bars too low. And then they just don't try, or they don't achieve.
Yeah, you make a conscious effort and you say to yourself, you know, my goal is to jump 2 meters, and 2 meters is really high. So if I jumped 1.80 meters, you know, that would be really great too, but I'm going to aim for two meters.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. Mm. Have you experienced the same kind of goal setting in your life, or?
You know, I sort of recently just had like a big turn off, like the concept of goal setting for me, because I found what would happen is I was writing, like literally in the last week I did this.
Yeah.
I would be writing goals, and I would find myself moving away from what I really wanted, and I would move towards something that looked good, or something that would come out real slick, you know, like,
right.
You know, what do you want to achieve? Oh, I want to be a lawyer. Lawyer's a good thing, good job to be a lawyer, you know?
Yeah.
It is this very acceptable goal, but maybe your goals aren't that, you know, I listened to this, this podcast with Rick Rubin and Andre 3000.
Yes.
You know, did you listen to it?
No, but that sounds amazing.
You know, he is the guy from Outkast, if anyone's wondering. But, you know, he said, you know, everyone thinks I'm kind of odd at the moment because I haven't got these huge goals. Like, my biggest goal now is to go to a park and be able to jam with someone on the bass clarinet, you know? And that's what he wants to achieve.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's okay if your goals are not...
audacious.
Yeah, audacious or economically rewarding.
Yes.
I find, you know... we often feel we have to have economic rewarding goals, and there's a lot of pressure to feel that way.
Well, because it's perceived success.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, what I sort of decided what I'm going to try and do now is, you know, I don't feel like I need to set goals as much. Like, I have this one general goal, and it seems to work fine, you know. I go to uni, and I get, you know, 6 out of 7, and I would just keep doing that. You know, that is good enough for me. Like, I am certainly not a perfectionist. Like, To get from something from being 80% good to 100% good is so much harder for me than to get it from 0 to 80. Like, 0 to 80 is so much fun.
Yeah.
But when you really start fine-tuning stuff, for me, I'm just like, oh, it's not for me.
Mm.
You know? And that job is really important too. Fine-tuning is really important. But for me, I was like, you know, I don't think that's my place, you know, to be fine-tuning. You know, let someone else do that. You know, it's okay if I'm not the best at everything.
Yeah.
But what I generally decided was that, you know, I'm just going to do uni and, you know, get those grades I want. And then for everything else in my life, I'm just going to try and move towards what I want more.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I'm not trying to plan everything so hectically, but instead just be like, you know, what do I want to do in this moment? You know, if that's, you know, play guitar or read a book, or maybe it's just do nothing. You know, that's okay. You know, the problem I see, like, foresee happening is it's very easy for things just to suck your attention away and not feel good about it. You know, like, you just watch, you know, Netflix for 10 hours, and at the end of it, you're like, geez, that movie was shit. You know? Like,
yeah.
And it's like, well, TV series, 10 hours, long movie.
Yeah.
But, you know, everything is really vying for your attention. And a lot of companies sell attention, you know, like newspapers sell attention. If there's ads on something, what they sell is attention.
Yeah.
And they want your attention.
Yeah.
So they can sell it.
Well, that's also, I think, too, in what we were talking about earlier with my friend Nicole, was there's this gravitational pull for a lot of people to create that same idea of attention pulling in our social media, in conducting our lives. It's like you never post the worst of your day, you always post the best. You always post, oh, I'm here at this place in the Maldives and all this sort of stuff. Like, you'll never post the worst. You're always going to attention seek and grab the best.
Yeah. I feel like social media and seeing people's success as you see people who are successful by social media standards, like the way they edit photos and the way they post and they figure out a posting schedule, I feel like it is a really fabulous example of showing that you know, there are skills you can learn outside of university, and university is not this core thing.
That is a really interesting perspective. I like this.
Because some people become phenomenal at it. Like, you can laugh at that 19-year-old girl who does, like, the funny poses. But, you know, she has caught, you know, 500,000 followers' attention.
And, yeah.
You know, she was flat out passing high school. You know, like, she has value in this realm.
Yeah.
I think it is up to her to hold that value in a way which creates a meaningful life and a life that she wants for her. Like, it's very easy just to be sucked in a hole of, you know, unhappiness. But it doesn't take away from the fact that that person is very, very good at this thing. They're very, very good at, you know, getting people to like what they like. Or, you know, when you see just dumb memes on the internet, but everyone see them.
Yeah.
Like, whoever made that meme is very, very good at what they do.
Do, yeah.
You know, and we may not economically value it, but maybe they will in some way. Like, you know, those people who write memes, they are basically copywriters. You know, they are writing basically an advertisement for this thing they've made. Like, maybe they will get a job in copywriting, but they didn't go to university to learn to write memes. You know, it's just this thing they enjoyed.
Yeah.
You know, and they kept doing it, you know, and they posted memes. People posted memes at internet trash for no money for years, you know, on all these forums. And it's only, you know, in the past couple of years, it's been commercialized.
Mm.
And now companies like Pepsi and stuff will hire people to make memes for them, you know. They're like, man, look how many people click these memes. This, yeah, clickbait.
This gets this, you know, attention.
Yeah. And they, a lot of those people figure it out pretty organically, you know. A lot of it has to do with just copying what other people do. You know, like, headline writing has been in newspapers for years, and now we just write headlines for clickbait, and we do it in a more extreme way.
Yeah.
But, you know, it is still a skill. I think what I'm getting at is the point is, people develop these skills and they do these things they're very, very good at.
Yeah.
And it's, I guess what I'm saying, that it's good to do things that you're good at and you're drawn to.
Yeah. I think there's there's passion in that, and I think there's almost like a degree of, even though if it's something, say, like a meme, you can't see the person's personality behind that or whatever, but there is this, I don't know, there's this like connection to the greater, you know, world or being or whatever, when you're doing something with what you love, like something with purpose, and whatever that purpose is completely fine and up to you. Like the simplest purpose of making someone's day or making someone laugh or whatever should not be taken away from something like, oh, I want to cure cancer, or I want to, you know, rebuild a culture or a society. Like, they, I think they all have merit and they all have a weight to them that helps grow and build who we are in everyday life.
Yeah, you know, I think that making memes and trash for the internet is, you know, it is creating art, you know, it is. And I was reading this interview with Kurt Vonnegut the other day. He's a writer, he wrote a bunch of books, which some people will think are just ridiculous. But, you know, lots of people bought them, so they became commercially successful, and he was therefore acceptable.
Yeah.
I think he was a cool dude.
Yeah.
And, you know, he said, you know, I feel everyone should practice an art, you know, whether it's singing or dancing or writing poems. And I would say now that, you know, making crappy memes to show your friends is an art too, you know, it's this creative endeavor.
Yeah.
But just the art and practicing the art themselves is the process of becoming, and that's what enriches your life.
Yeah.
You know, doing that will make you feel better. And you don't have to show anyone. Like, he suggested, you know, just write a poem and make it as good as you can, and then just tear it up and throw it away, you know. Just that, the act, and the act of being and practicing the art, that is, that will fulfill you in itself, you know. There doesn't have to be this end game output. Like, you don't have to make memes to try and get a job with Pepsi.
Yeah.
You know, you can do it just because you enjoy it, and that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Is there anything else you want to cover before we wrap this baby up?
Oh, not really. I feel like we jumped around.
Oh, that was good, though. That was a lot of subject matter just covered. Guys, that was episode 10 of Coffee is My Boyfriend. My name's Anissa. This is my good friend and brother from another mother, Tom. Say goodbye.
Goodbye, everyone.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. That was awesome. I'm really happy with that.
Glad you're happy with it.
All right. Bye.